Welcome to Worlds Apart. The tragedy of the war in Ukraine is so visceral and so dramatic that it may easily conceal other repercussions and other victims of the Russian-Western clash, which has already adversely affected many countries, especially in the global south. How is this seemingly far away regional conflict seen from the largest and one of the most ethnically diverse countries in South America? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Gilson Schwartz, professor of economics at the University of Sao Paulo in Brazil. Professor Schwartz, it's great to see you. Great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me in your show. And I hope we will go smoothly through the conversation, despite all the glitches that may come up during, you know, the Wi-Fi connection that I'm using right now.
Yeah, there's indeed a huge distance between the two of us. You're in São Paulo, I'm in Moscow, but I'm sure people in your hack of the woods are also watching and following this conflict, because it has already affected much of the globe, if not directly, then perhaps indirectly. How much interest do you see from your countrymen to what's happening, you know, worlds apart in Ukraine?
Well, Brazil is really a big territory. As you mentioned, we have a diversity of ethnic groups. In that sense, it's quite similar to the Russian history. We are heirs to the colonial tradition. So we had cycles of different dominant powers overruling the Brazilian, what now is the Brazilian territory. But the fact is that the sheer size of the country implies that maintaining the order, maintaining peace, or keeping the territory as an integral part of one government has always been the main challenge to anyone governing Brazil. So in that sense, we're kind of an endogamic country. We don't have a tradition, especially among the press, we don't have a tradition of actually engaging with international issues, but of course, one key element in the present situation is the impact of imports of fertilizers, for instance, into the agricultural sector in Brazil. Brazil is highly dependent on imports of fertilizers. So in that sense, the shock of supply chains being disturbed by the conflict, that certainly impacts the living conditions in Brazil, although I'm not that sure that the Brazilian population is totally aware of the connections between higher inflation, for instance, or food prices and the conflict in Europe.
And Professor Schwartz, I hope we can shed some light on those connections. But before we go into economic specifics, I want to ask you a broader question, because here in Eurasia, I think we still romanticize the notion of the great games, you know, this, you know, historic political and diplomatic struggles between great powers for Central Asia or for some other territories. And I was struck the other day by hearing one of the most prominent and most respected Russian analysts very soberly say that it's not a game anymore. It's a fully fledged war between Russia and the West, still a hybrid war, but a war nonetheless. Do you agree with such definition that it's a fully fledged war?
Anyone who's, of course, watching what's going on and following up the news can very quickly realize that, at least from the narrative perspective, the South is not that much engaged in that grand narrative. I think that both the West and Russia, they are very much engaged in a clearly framed narrative. Where, as you mentioned, the West and Eurasia are fighting for cultural hegemony or for economic issues. But from down here in the South, if you follow the comments by many leaders, be it in Africa or in South Asia, in South America, you don't see that kind of narrative. The usual, let's say, excuse for not being that much engaged in the conflict or not being totally aligned to the US or to the Western position, the usual, let's say, excuse is that this is not our business. Mm-hmm. In a sense, most of these leaders, if you go to the United Nations, you also see that kind of pattern. Differently from what happened in the past, when we had the Cold War, for instance, the Cold War was a clear division here in Brazil, for instance. There was a clear division between those who are pro-US and those who are pro-Soviet. Now what I see is more of a pragmatic position, a strategic issue, as I mentioned, here in Brazil, where the agricultural sector is so important. A strategic issue here is mostly fertilizers. We are highly dependent on the import of fertilizers. What we've seen, the government is very much engaged into improving logistics and the use of a fertilizer, or even stimulating local industries to develop fine chemicals, petrochemicals, and all that. Brazil is also very important in that area. But really, I understand the major issues that are, of course, at stake in the conflict between Russia and the West. But as a matter of fact, those in the South, they don't buy a strictly geopolitical narrative. They're more into, let's say, making sure they survive very pragmatically. And this is, I think, clear. You can see this, interestingly enough, irrespective of being more to the right or more to the left. They are not totally clear about the geopolitical issues. I think we lack
Professor, can I ask you something? Because you say that people are not very attuned to geopolitical implications, but you also come from a region with a very long history of Western and specifically American meddling, because I interviewed your former president, Lula da Silva, last year, and he's pretty open that the Americans have been treating Latin America as if it were their own backyard. And whenever there is an authentic move towards democracy, there's always, at least according to him, there's always a coup that follows. And in his view, Americans are one of the main blocks on the way of a region democratizing itself genuinely, authentically, rather than to suit the American plans. I wonder how prominent is this issue from your perspective, how prominent is this issue of democracy and democratic governance in the Ukrainian conflict? Because this is obviously part of the Western narrative that they are trying to support the weak or the fledgling Ukrainian democracy. Do you believe it?
I think that this varies historically. This varies historically. The role of the United States in terms of meddling with Latin American issues, Central American issues, of course. One thing is the border between the U.S. and Mexico, where you have a direct issue, a frontier, territorial issues concerning immigration and all that. And a different situation, of course, is Brazil is way southward, and we don't have a frontier issue, although there are so many Brazilians that also migrate to the U.S. looking for jobs and all that. It depends on the situation. For instance, when we were under a military dictatorship back in the 60s and 70s, when the Democrats came to power in the U.S. and they held a very pro-democratic policy in terms of their foreign policy, that was helpful in bringing the military regime down in Brazil at that time. On the other hand, before that, when we had the military coup in 64, they were very important in terms of supporting the Brazilian military, the extreme right, into, of course, becoming a dictatorship. If you go even backwards in the history, you can see that, for instance, even the military, Brazilian military, they were very important at that time in the post-war, during the Second World War and immediately after the Second World War, when the Allies were Westerns and the Russians and the Soviet Union against the Nazis. Immediately after the war, once the Nazis were defeated, there was a kind of a miracle period when everyone was in favor of democracy, and most of the military that came back from the war effort, they were favoring democracy, and then dictator Getúlio Vargas was ousted. So I think it really depends on the situation, but of course, from a geopolitical perspective, there has been a very long tradition of, sharing the planet in terms of regions of strategic interest. And of course, Latin America belongs, so to speak, to the U.S. influence. On the other hand, we should not downplay the importance of European influence in Brazil. That's interesting in Brazil, the fact that despite all the U.S. influence, there is a very important influence from European powers. This is a colonial territory, a former colony of Portugal. And then we were, of course, very much influenced by different ways of immigration. So you will find in Brazilian society and even among the elites, lots of people that came from Italy, from Spain, from Japan, from Germany.
And even from Russia. I remember being in Brazil, in São Paulo specifically, and meeting a lot of Russian immigrants. So you guys indeed have had a lot of political, cultural influence from all around the world. And you said before that perhaps this is one of the factors that allows you now to try to maintain your strategic neutrality for the sake of your own economic and perhaps social interests. But I wonder how challenging it is, because we know from other countries that the United States has put a lot of pressure onto other capitals to make them take what they call a more principled, or rather in real terms, a more pro-Western position.
Well, I like to compare Brazil and even South America to a triangle. If you look at the map, you'll see that it's more or less a triangle. And where you have the sizes of the triangle, you have the Pacific Ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, and North America. That implies that South America has at least an opportunity to play with partners both to the west and to the east. And of course, there's this strategic relationship with the U.S. But for instance, for many years, we used to say here that the second largest German industrial city is São Paulo. So the presence of German automakers or chemical industry in the city and the state of São Paulo is really impressive. So Brazil must, from a economic perspective, Brazil must be more pragmatic. At times, it will, of course, be more aligned. But you see, for instance, some interesting issues, some very important issues in terms of the political positioning of the Brazilian government. Let's say the Middle East issue, which is really thorny, very hot issue for so many decades. Brazil was very important when the State of Israel was created back in 1948, 49. Brazil was very important at that time. On the other hand, Brazil has a tradition, irrespective of the who's in power, it has a tradition of supporting Palestinian rights and Palestinian efforts. So it's for those who are not in Brazil, it might look a little bit strange or schizophrenic maybe, because Brazil is always swinging between positions.
You can call it swinging or you can call it balancing. And this is what any complicated, complex country would be expected to do, because the world is such a complicated place. It's not divided into good and evil anymore. Anyway, Professor Schwartz, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Since the breakaway of the Donetsk People's Republic, war's been raging in Donbass. Ukrainian artillery's been shelling civilian towns and mining villages there.
Прильот! Вот! Дым! Возле нас прилетело! Прильот! Вот он, прильот! Ну что, вы видели все своими глазами? Прилетело буквально 50 метров от нас, взорвалось Д-30. Слава богу, осколки не в нас полетели. Валим.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Dilson Schwartz, professor of economics at the University of São Paulo in Brazil. Professor Schwartz, before the break, we were talking about this very difficult, very challenging balancing act that Brazil is trying to maintain on the international scene. And I understand that there are many tricky geopolitical issues, but for example, when it comes to issues of human health or, you know, human wellness, even there it seems that there are major choices to be made. And what I'm talking about here is that a couple of years back, when the COVID pandemic was at its highest, the Americans tried to put pressure on you to make sure that you reject the Russian-made vaccine. And what surprised me at that time is that the United States described that vaccine as a malign influence detrimental to U.S. safety and security. It's actually been put into their report. Do you think we, the Russians, can ever come to any sort of peaceful coexistence with the Americans or with the Westerners when even such a life-saving product as vaccines are categorized as the threat to the U.S. safety and security?
Well, the same happened with the Chinese vaccines. The Brazilian government, well, at least the recent one, was very, very positioned, very much positioned at the extreme right. The president himself was a negationist and has always been a critic of Chinese vaccines, and even called COVID a Chinese issue, a Chinese malaise. But even at the beginning of the pandemic, we can remember that even the World Health Organization was kind of cautious before openly stating that there was a pandemic going on. I think that the relationship in terms of diplomacy, the relationship between the Russia and the West, as with many other regions of the world, India, of course, China, Africa, and in all these histories, we cannot ignore that we are in a post-colonial era. It's of course very clear that the capitalist development in the West became a machine of war. I mean, for many, many years, we could always spot crises, moments of crisis, when only war could, let's say, save capitalism from deep destruction, from revolution, or from major crisis. So I think that I don't want to sound too economicist, but as a matter of fact, we know that there is a very strict connection between the development of capitalist societies and the use of violence. Is this from the start? From against
can I people. Be a little bit more specific? Do you think the war in Ukraine is a consequence of that? Were the differences between Russia and the West indeed so irreconcilable prior to this conflict that they could only be solved on the battlefield?
I think there are very very significant, meaningful indicators that the conflict was a mounting process. The tensions were accumulating. And from both sides, there was a perception of weakness. I remember at the end of the Soviet Union, the West has celebrated Russia. So at times, it will be a very solid and I would say, even overexcited support. At the end
it
of Soviet
was Union, excited support for Russia that was on its knees, to use a cliche, but it was a very weak Russia, a Russia that treated its own people very poorly. Was it really Russia that the West was celebrating, or rather the very sorry condition that Russia was in?
I would say that there was a hope that a capitalist elite would take over in Russia and become partner with the capitalist elites of the West. So at that time, there was a strategic interest in supporting a very fast transition, a very fast privatization process. I remember American scholars that went to Russia to really defend a shock treatment. I remember that because in Brazil, it was more or less the same. Many people advocating shock treatments to convert Brazil into a hyper-capitalist economy. So I think that we have to go into a very, very, to the bottom line, I think. The connection or the partnership among countries, especially the East and the West, really depends on overcoming some basic issues that are related to the process of capital accumulation, to the process of domination through violence. Mm-hmm. Of course, yep. This is utopian. This is utopian, but there has been, let's say, at least 200 years of people both in the East and the West discussing the limits of a limitless capitalist accumulation. So how can you establish limits to development, to growth, or to capital accumulation when the system itself is limitless? I mean, there is a trend, an inner trend to overexploit the natural resources, to destroy the environment, and of course, to overexploit the human labor. Technology also plays a role here, because as accumulation proceeds, there is, let's say, an inherent or endogenous impulse to save on labor or to increase the productivity of labor, introducing technologies that increase productivity, but of course, income distribution does not follow. So there is a connection here between the mode of production, the development model, and the perspectives for democracy, both internally and internationally.
These days, I speak to a lot of non-Western thinkers from, you know, India, Pakistan, Africa, China, the Philippines, now from Brazil, and they come from very different life contexts with very different, ideological positions, but they all stress one point, that their countries should focus first and foremost on their own practical, pragmatic issues that have direct relevance to people's lives. And it is if, it may look like a new incarnation of the non-aligned movement that we had back in the Cold War days, but not the political non-aligned movement, but rather economic non-aligned movement. Could that offer some hope that those countries that don't have a stake in this conflict, that they may actually try to defend the fair rules of the game for all?
I think that the main difference between what's going on now and the non-alignment era, so to speak, is, well, two. First, of course, the economic issue that's prominent. But I think that another very, very important thing, a process that's going on now that did not take place at that time in the Cold Era, is really the role of China. So what I see now, for instance, the BRICS, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa coalition. We have just witnessed, like a couple of weeks ago, the Chinese government asking or inviting for an expansion of BRICS. So it's not really a re-edition of non-alignment, but I think that the East-West conflict is not so straightforward in a sense that China, who backs, in a sense, mostly backs the Russian position, but of course, the Chinese have their own interests as well. And they are also looking forward to a world regime or to a political, geopolitical regime in the future where China plays a larger role. They've been investing a lot in what we call soft power and importance of Chinese-Africa relations and Chinese-Latin American, China and the BRICS. So I think that it looks like, or it sounds like, the non-alignment. In a sense, that's true, because economic factors are really very critical here in terms of survival and stabilization policies among less developed countries. But I think there is another piece on the board, and this is the Chinese game, the Chinese interests that do not converge either with the US or the Russians. They have their own geopolitical strategies.
But correct me if I'm wrong, but my perception of the Chinese policies is at least that surely they're pursuing their own interests, but they're letting other countries choose for themselves. They are offering, they're not just coming with empty rhetoric like the United States, trying to persuade everybody to choose values over valuables while, you know, accruing all the benefits for Washington, but they're actually offering something in return. They're offering loans, they're offering infrastructure projects, what have you. Don't you think that this system, while it seems to be sort of a little bit skewed in favor of China, it also gives other countries more freedom and more ability to choose for themselves?
I think that the key issue in terms of both economics and politics right now is the future of technology. So we've seen, even during the Trump administration, and Biden does not change that in any way, I think that the technology issue here is very important, especially in the telecommunications area. So, of course, 5G and all the discussions about the next generation of telecommunication infrastructures, that's the key point. It's not as much territorial as it is about creating a framework for the expansion of the internet or the expansion of digital services of the digital economy. So I think that the Chinese, they have invested a lot in technology, and they have been very, very important in terms of penetrating different markets with digital infrastructures. Huawei is it's a global player. We have now TikTok, which is a major, major force among children and youth everywhere. So I think that the Chinese game is more sophisticated now. And of course, direct investment, foreign direct investment is an important piece. Chinese have invested in Brazil, for instance, in the electric and energy matrix, in the energy infrastructure. It all relates to the future of technology on the one hand, and a very important aspect of these new technologies, that is currencies. There is no possibility whatsoever of a new world order without a new financial landscape. That's why Chinese lending is so important, as well as Chinese investments in technology, because we know for sure that paper money is something of the past. It's now everything is about digital transfers, wire transfers. You see that one of the sanctions was the suspension of Russia from SWIFT, which is a long-standing infrastructure for financial transactions. It's totally wired, a system for wired transfers of money. So I think that the Chinese game, so to speak, is very much focusing on technology, telecommunications, and not only the markets that come out of these new technologies, but also the financial infrastructure that will be built. It's already been under development. It's a new financial landscape that it's very difficult to censor, it's very difficult to control, but you can see that the digital yuan and or the digital renminbi or the digital real, everyone is in a rush to achieve this next stage of financial development that depends on telecommunications.
And Professor Schwartz, let's hope that the Chinese will be more pragmatic, more strategic, and wiser about the use of this newly accrued currency muscle than the Americans have been. Anyway, thank you very much for being with us. We have to leave it there.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And let's hope for the best. I think that, as you said, maybe it's not a harmony that's coming up, but certainly a more complex reality where the Cold War dichotomies will be overcome. Thank you very much for the opportunity of being with you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.